We start at the bottom of Nun Chet Amud Bet. We just review the Braisa, because the Gemara today is going to deal with the last Braisa that we brought down. The Gemara was bringing it for a different reason. If you remember yesterday, we had a question that was posed to the Reish Galuta about someone who destroyed a palm tree of his friend. And the Reish Galuta wanted to just assess the value of the palm tree in the context of the three palm trees that were there. And it was challenged by one of the litigants, and they went to Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman said that you do it b'shishim, right? That's the principle that we've learned from our Mishnah and from the Gemara above, that any assessment is done in a relative to 60 times, depending on the machlokas of what, 60 times of what, but relative 60 times. So then Rava responded in defense of the Reish Galuta that maybe there's a difference between mono hamazik, where we say ubir b'steacher, when his mamon does damage, where there's a requirement for 60 times, versus gufo the mazik, when he himself does the hezek, we don't have any requirement, we don't have any pasuk there that tells us that he has to do, right, he has to pay b'shishim, he has to pay an assessment within the context of 60 times. Abaye says, Rava, where do you get that from? So, oh, you get it from the fact that the Braisa brings down a case by where he does a mazik b'gufo, and doesn't mention the term 60. He says, well, I'll bring you another Braisa down that talks about a behema, which is memono that does damage, and it doesn't say 60. So what are you going to have to answer by behema? By memono, you're going to have to answer that the Braisa, even though it didn't say 60, it meant 60. So too by the person. Even though it didn't say 60, it meant 60. So Abaye rejects Rava's proposition, and he, again, defends the position of Rav Nachman. So you have Rava is like the Reish Galuta, and you have Abaye, who seems to be following the position of Rav Nachman. So now the second Braisa that they brought down is the Braisa I'm going to go over. And when we go over that Braisa, then the Gemara is going to dissect that Braisa at this point. So I'm just going to start at the bottom of Nun Chet Amud Bet. We'll just run through it quickly. The Tanya. Mavkir Kamo, Shel Chavero. Person who destroys the vineyard of his friend, Smadar. It was at the point already where it had reached the point of being a Smadar, which is already, you know, the fruit buds had already appeared on the vines. We say, how much was the beforehand, after which was it after? Over there, we don't mention 60. So, don't we have the same thing by behema? Right, in Braisa, the Tanya, kitma netiya, if an animal comes and uproots a sapling. Rabbi Yossi omer, guzre gzerot shushalayim omrim netiya bat shnata, if it's a one-year-old sapling, shtei kesef, you pay two kesef. Bat shteishan, if it's a two-year-old sapling, arba kesef. Achla chaziz, if it eats grains, right, that are not at to full maturity, then Rabbi Yossi gli omer nidon mimishu yar shibot. Then we look at the remaining part of the field, when it grows to maturity, and then we compare what the value of this area would have been had it grown to maturity. And again, we pointed this out, Tosafot pointed out yesterday, that when Tvu'ah, we look at what the rest of the field does. Why do we look at what the rest of the field does? Is because by Tvu'ah, there's an assumption that all the field grows in the same quality and the same afflictions or problems will affect all the Tvu'ah of the field. So therefore, we look at whatever remained, and we see what it produced. If it produced nothing, then he really didn't cost him anything. If it produces full-grown grain and good grain, then we say that that's what it could have produced, and he's got to make up for what he caused, the loss that he caused this individual. Now, we look how much it was worth before he did the damage afterwards. Achlas madar. If the animal ate a smadar, so again, what smadar here is the fruit buds. Rabbi Shua omer, ro'oinoto kilhena navim omdot li batzer. We look at them as if they are grapes that are reached their full maturity, and he'll pay based on what a grape at full maturity was. So where Tosus draws the distinction by grapes, the Gemara doesn't say Mishuya Shabo. The Gemara doesn't say over here, the leftover grapes on the vine, we assess it, because there's a feeling by grapes, by vineyards, that they are very particular, and every vine can produce at different quality rates and also at under different conditions. That even though some of the vines may not produce or other grapes don't survive, doesn't mean that these grapes would not have survived, that there is such a distinction within grapes. And therefore, we looked at what would have been a ripe grape worth, not whether the remaining grapes here succeeded or not. Again, how much was it worth? How much is it worth now after he destroyed it? Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Omer Mishum Rabbi Shimon, Vamed Varim Amurim, when do we say that, that we assign, look at the diminished value? That's only if he ate something that was not yet fruit. I mean that he ate gifanim, the shoots of the gifen, and the, you know, when they're still green, or the beginning of the clusters, v'yichurei teinim, and the, again, the shoots of the figs, but before they reach the fruit state. V'alachla pagim, both there, if he eats the te'ina, which it would be called the pag, or boser, which is in the anavim, which are unripened fruit, we look at it until the point then when it would have reached maturity, we say how much was the value of that item. So k'tani mihat, v'chamim arim otah, kama ita yafa, v'kami yafa. Chamim, nevertheless, say that we look at the assessed value against what could have been and what it is now, meaning that what it was just in this period of time. V'loktani b'shishim. And they're missing this whole idea of assessment of 60. What are you going to say? B'shishim. You have to say that it's within the context of 60, because nobody disagrees when your animal does damage that you assess it within the context of 60. So we have to read that into the Braisa. And that's what Abai says to Rava. You have to read that into the Braisa when he did the damage also. So Achanami B'shishim. So now, Amar Abai. Abai makes a general statement now. Rabbi Yossi Aglili was just found in that Braisa that we just spoke about, which says, Nidon B'mishuyar Shibo. By the Tvua, we look at what it would have been if the Tvua reached full maturity, and then he pays based on that amount. V'Rabbi Yishmael, Amru Devar Echad. And Rabbi Yishmael say one have the same opinion. So Rabbi Yossi Aglili had the Amran. Yossi Aglili was the Rabbi Yossi Aglili we just mentioned in our Braisa. Rabbi Yishmael, who is Rabbi Yishmael? The Tanya. Meitav Sadeyu U'Meitav Karmo Yishalem. So Meitav Sadeyu Shal Nizak U'Meitav Karmo Shal Nizak Divei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael says you assess based on the value of the Nizak. Rabbi Gilbert Merlo, Bakatu Velo Gabot Nizakim Min Ayidit. Pasuk only comes to take from the Nezik from the best. V'kavachom le'ekdesh. Then we learned earlier in the Gemara, right? On Daf Omud Bet, we also had the same Sugi and Gittin. The Gemara there dissects what is the real machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara's conclusion over there is that the machlokas between them relates to b'dinizak shaminon or b'dimazik shaminon. According to Rabbi Shmuel, we assess everything based on the nizak, Zak's property levels. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, we assess it on the value of the mazik. There were other propositions in the Gemara over there. One of those propositions was that of Rabbi Idi Bar Avin. That's what the Gemara says. V'lo temak Rabbi Idi Bar Avin. Don't explain the machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva like Rabbi Idi Bar Avin. Dama Rabbi Idi Bar Avin kagon she'achla aruga ben harugot. It's a case, he tried to explain the machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva as such. If an animal goes into a field and eats a patch, but we don't know what type of patch he eats. And this field has different levels, different qualities within it. So we're unsure as to which one of the patches he ate. Did he eat a high-quality patch or a low-quality patch? Damar kum shalim shmena. Right? B'metav. De'ika hashto. Right? So go and pay the best that's there. That's what it means. Metav sedeo, metav karimo yishalim. He should pay the best of what's there. I mean, we don't know what he ate. We assume he ate the best. Dahachilo amrinan, right? We don't say that, my taima, because amotzi mechaver olav araya. So we reject this explanation of Rav Idi Bar Avin because it makes no sense. When you have a safek, when it comes to monetary matters, we never impose, right, on the person the worst scenario. Worst scenario meaning that he has to pay the most possible, because whenever someone wants to change the status quo, he's got to bring proof. And over here, what we can assume he ate, the minimum value. And if you want to take any more money from the mazik, you got to prove, right, that he ate more than just the lowest quality field here. So that's an explanation. Ella, b'meitav d'lekamei. So no, it must be the meitav that's in front of him. What does it mean, the meitav that's in front of him? Umay nihu keheach d'salik. Like what the field ends up producing. So that's the explanation. According to Abaye, the explanation of Rabbi Shmuel's position is that meitav sedir, meitav karmai shalem is b'nizak shamin. What does it mean, b'nizak? We look at what the final output will be, what the final production of this field will be, and we look at the final production, b'nizak, of the nizak shemina, that tells us what you're going to pay now for the damage that you did. And that's identical to the opinion of Rabbi Yossi Aglili in the Braisa, that we look at the future production or future quality of what is produced in the field, and then we assess the damage that you did over here. Obviously, the Gemara in Tosfos points is that we know that the Gemara in other places says that the machlokas is between Nizak Shaminan or Mazik Shaminan. So all of a sudden, how do we get to this? The Tosfos says there are actually two machlokot here between Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shmuel. One machlokas is about the Nizak Shaminan and the Mazik Shaminan, and a second machlokas, which is about do we assess based on the Mishuyar, right? That the Rabbi Shmuel believes that if we look at Mishuyar, we look at what's the final output of the field, and based on that, we'll assess the damage there. And Rabbi Akiva says, no, but the Mazik Shemin, it means that literally whatever you damage you did, you pay for how much is it worth today, and how much was it worth after you did the damage. We don't wait until the harvest to find out what future destruction that you created at this point in time. There'll be another machlokas, an additional difference between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. So, David, you wanted to ask something? Yeah. No, not the best, but he has to pay as if the grapes reached maturity. So I think there's a difference, meaning that when you say Motzi Mechaver Alav Araya, the assumption is that if you look at the final production, you only take the best grapes. That you'll have to be Motzi Mechaver Alav Araya. But the fact that he pays based on the grape at its maturity, that's not Motzi Mechaver Alav Araya. That's the way that that's the damage that he caused. He caused damage because he didn't allow the grape to reach maturity. So he has to pay now a grape that would have reached maturity. But the underlying assumption, wait, the quality is right, so he'll have to pay, he'll pay the lowest quality. But in terms of we don't know it'll reach maturity, that I don't know is fair, because the Gemara's underlying assumption is that it always reaches maturity. I mean, that's the assumption that the grape will reach maturity, and that you don't need a raya for. You don't need a raya to show that a grape will reach maturity. What you do have to bring a raya for is the quality of the maturity, and therefore he'll pay based on the lowest quality of production in that field, or lowest, and that if you want Motzi Mechaver Alav Araya, wouldn't demand that he pays beyond that. In a, more than just the a minimum grape at maturity, but a grape at maturity that's of a higher quality. That would require Motzi Mechaver Alav Araya. Well, there you know, because when you use Mishuyar, right, when you use Mishuyar, it's a lot easier, because then you know what the field produced. You know what the final production of the field is, then you can just compare it against the Mishuyar. It's a bigger question when you deal with grapes, because grapes, you're not looking at the rest of the field. You're just saying that we automatically assume it reaches maturity. So there's no context. Right. Well, the assumption is if everything around a field grows, that's what Tosu's point is, that a field grows at a steady growth. And so if the rest of the field grew to this quality or height, then the assumption is that everything in the field would have grown at the same pace or same quality. All right. So Amamar. So now we have to discuss the other Tanoim here, which is what David was asking about. Amamar, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Omer Mishum Rabbi Shimon, B'meh Dvarim Amorim She'achla Luluvei Gifanim V'yichurei Te'inim. Hasmadar. Right, so now if you look, we have different stages over here. Right, you have the case of lulevei gifanim and yuchrei teinim, which are pre-fruit. Right, that's a pre-fruit level. Then right after that in the Mishnah we discuss, which are pagim and boser. Pagim and boser are fruits that are just not ripened, but they're well-developed fruits, just not ripe yet. So what you skipped between those two stages is the smadar, which is the budding fruit. So the budding fruit stands between, right, the buds before there's fruit, and the unripened fruit, and that Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda never distresses. So what's the status of that? So then you assess, you know, how much the field was worth before, how much is worth afterwards. Hasmadar, but a budding fruit, then we'll look at it as if they reached full maturity, and you'll pay full mature grapes. Ema Seifa, then what are you going to do with the next line in the Braisa? Achla Pagim Oboser. If he eats the unripened fruits, but these are already fruits that are well developed, Hu Deroina Takilo Navim Omdot Livatzer. Right? Hasmadar, Roentu Kamahi Yafa, Vakamai Tayafa. Right? You look at how much it was worth before and afterwards. So Smadar, you can be Medayek either way. I mean, you have two statements in the mission that skip the stage of Smadar. One talking about pre fruit, you have one that's unripened fruit but well developed. What we don't address is this budding fruit, the smadar. And the smadar, depending if you medayik from the seifa or you medayik from the first statement of Rabbi Shimon, you're going to end up with different conclusions with regards to the smadar. So, ihachi, so the Gemara says, I'm sorry, ihachi, aval achla smadar pagimo bos, I skipped something here. Zamar avina, kroch vetani. Join the two statements together and say this. That that's only if he eats pre-fruit stages that we say how much was it worth before, how much is it worth now. If he eats the budding fruit, pagim oboser, or ripe, unripened fruit, so smadar will be included in that second category over there. So Gemara says, Yihochi, Rabbi Shimon Yehuda, Hainu Rabbi Yeshua. Now we have Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda and Rabbi Yeshua saying the exact same thing, which is basically, when you hit the point of smadar, right? When you hit the budding fruit stage already, then we look at it, how much it's going to reach at maturity. So they're both saying the same thing. So Gemara says, the difference between them is kichesh gufna. Right? There's a concept called kichesh gufna, v'lo b'saima. We don't know who holds of what, which one holds of this. Now, kichesh gufna is a point that when you have a fruit that grows on a tree, right, the fruit derives its sustenance or its nutrition from the tree itself, which actually diminishes the amount of nutrition that the tree or the vine has for itself. So when the fruits go over there, they are actually, in a sense, diminishing the ability of the vine or the tree to grow or to expand itself. So based on that, if you have fruits on the tree or fruits on the vine and they successfully grow, right, then they've actually damaged the tree, quote-unquote damaged the tree. The fruits off the tree, you allow the tree to grow in a fuller manner. It's equivalent of when you prune, right? When you prune a tree, you take off the dead branches, you take off branches. By taking some branches off, the tree grows to a stronger, fuller growth. So same thing with the fruits. If you take the fruits off, the tree will grow fuller. So based on that, when I remove the fruits from the tree, what do I pay? Do I just pay for what the grapes would have been worth at the end? I mean, that I come to pick the grapes at maturity, what would they have been worth, and now I have to compensate him for that loss? Or do I also get to subtract? Do I get to subtract the added value I gave him? Why? Because he has a stronger vine now. He has a stronger tree now. So maybe I should get a credit. I should get a credit for the value I created by strengthening his tree and his vine. So that's the machlokas here. That'll be the difference between Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda and Rabbi Yeshua. Even though they both agree that you assess it on the final picked fruit, but nevertheless, do you give them a credit for this amount? So the Gemara says, Lo Misaime. They don't know whose is which opinion. Abaye Amar Misaime U Misaime. We know who says what. I'll tell you why. Man Tana de Chayesh de Kichesh Gufna. Who is the Tana that worries about or gives credit for a difference in what happens to the Karen? And we'll call it the Karen in this case. Where Bishim Ben Yehudi. So Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, how do we know this? D'tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, Omer Mishum, Rabbi Shimon ben Asya, Ones, Einu Mashalem et Tzar. When it comes to an Ones, this is a case of a rape victim. So in a case of a rape victim, he has to pay all types of nezek or any damage that's done. And of course, he has to pay for the Moab Tulot. He has to pay the father for that. But then, on the other hand, does he have to pay for Tzar? The Tzar, because he was Boel a Betula. And Boel Betula creates pain for her. So Rabbi Shimon ben Asya says, no, ain't no mishalem at the tzar. Why? Mipnei shesofa lehitz te'er tachat bala. Because in the end, this woman would have gotten married, and when she got married and her husband had bia with her for the first time, she would experience that same tzar. So this person is not, this person is, has raped this individual, has not caused her any more tzar in the term of physical pain. I'm not talking about in the anguish or the mental pain, but in terms of the physical pain, it's an experience that she would otherwise have just at a later date. So he shouldn't have to pay for this tzar, because this tzar is not something that is unique to him. It's something that would have happened to this woman no matter what. So you see, according to Shimon ben Yehuda, Shimon ben Asya, that we give you a credit in a sense. We give you a, we take away from the payment the amount of what you would have experienced anyway. So Amar lo. So the Chachamim answered back to Shimon Asya, "Ain't odomen nivelet beratzon and nivelet bonus." No, there is a difference. Even when you talk about pain, there's a qualitative difference in pain between someone who is forced versus someone who does it willingly, and therefore you have to pay for that differential. There is tzar here. So Amar Abai, Hani Tnai, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda Amru Davar Echad. Shimon Yehuda and these other Tanaim, which we're going to see in a minute, all said one thing, and this is this idea that you get a credit for something that would otherwise have happened or you would have to pay for. Shimon ben Yehuda Hadamran. Shimon ben Yehuda is what we just said, right? The case here of Kichesh by Gufa, by the tsar of the woman who was raped. Hane Tanai Mai. With these other Tanaim that agree with his position, who are they? D'tanya. Rabbi Yossi Omer Nechi Chaya, Ben Azai Omer Nechi Mizonot. Rabbi Yossi and Ben Azai say that you reduce by the amount of the midwife, and the other one says you reduce by the amount of the Mizonot, the food that you would have to eat. What is the case here? The case here is where a woman was caused to miscarry. She's carrying, she's pregnant, and then because of a blow by an individual, she miscarries. Now this individual is chayev to compensate for the dmei v'ladot, right? For the miscarried baby, he's got to compensate here. But, on the other hand, he actually saved the husband some money here. Why did he save the husband money? Because in the end, the husband would have to pay for a midwife to birth this woman. If he had to, in the future, he would have to pay for a midwife, he saved him that expense because at this point the vladot are out, and he doesn't have to pay for this midwife in the future. Same thing with mizonot. He actually saved him money on food. Right? So I would have, the way I would have thought of food is that because the woman consumes more food because she's pregnant, and therefore all that additional food she would consume, right, he saved her. The way Rashi explains it is that the tsar of the chevle leida, it sounds like, caused the woman to be kishuya, that she eats more, or she's in that pain, she eats more food, and therefore he saved her that amount. But either way, what the point of these tanoim is that you get a credit for the money that you saved the Baal that he would have had to expend anyway. Because when you compensate over here, you're compensating for instance, in this case where she miscarries, you have to compensate for tsar. So the individual is compensating for pain. This is the pain of giving birth without a midwife. I mean, that part of what the pain here is that she's giving birth unexpectedly or unintentionally. And because of that, he compensates her for that pain that she didn't have a midwife give birth. So you've already taken into account, right, all that differential. So maybe, and this is what these two times say, well, I should get a credit for what I saved the Baal Nan, that he didn't use a midwife and that he didn't pay these extra mizonot. So Gemara says, "Vandamer minichi chaya koshke nichi mizonot." The one who says that you get a credit for the midwife certainly says you get a credit for the food. "Vandamer nichi mizonot." The one who says that you get a credit for the food, avon nichi chaya lo. Right, but when it comes to deduction for the midwife, we don't say that there. Why? "Darmalei itata didip kichahi." I got an expert woman. My wife gives birth. The lomi baye chaya. She doesn't need midwives, right? Like the women in Mitzrayim, right? Kichayotena. They don't need midwives. These women, my wife doesn't need a midwife, so you didn't save me any money. The only thing you saved me money on is the food, but you didn't save me money on the midwife. Either way, what we see is you have a consistent theme here of Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, you have Ben Azai, and you have Rabbi Yossi, all of the same opinion, which is that you get a credit for the savings that you generated by the damage that you did. And the same will be true here, the machlokes between Rabbi Shua and Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda, you get a credit for the benefit you gave to the tree by knocking the fruits off. So even though you have to pay for the full ripened fruit, what it would have been worth, but you get a deduction for the improvement that you caused to the tree, according to Rabbi Shimon Yehuda. And that would be the difference between the opinions of Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Shimon ben Yehuda. Now, the Gemara now has a psak halacha here. A papa Ravuna b'rei Rabbi Yeshua, avud uvda kavate de Rav Nachman b'shishim. They pass an halacha like Rav Nachman, which is that we did it at 60 times, meaning that they assessed the values at 60 times. Lishna achrina, there's another lashon about what they did. Rapav Ravuna Breda Vishur, Shamu Dikla Gav Katina Da'ara. They assessed the dekel, a palm tree, with the land around it, with a small piece of land or a parcel of land around it. Meaning that they didn't look at the dekel in isolation, they looked at the palm tree in the context of the area that it's in. So again, this is like the opinion of Rav Nachman from before, that you don't assess a dekel on a standalone basis. V'hilchasa, and the locha is kavati de rapapa ravuna b'rei de rabshua b'dikla darmo. When it comes to a Aramean dekel, then the locha is like them because it's not significant enough to stand on its own. Since it's not significant enough to stand on its own, therefore we assess it in the context of the field that it's found in or the context of 60 times. V'hilchasa kavati de resh galuta b'dikla parsa. But the halacha is like the resh galuta, that you look at the palm tree independently as a single unit when it comes to Persian dekalim, because Persian dekalim are so chashuv. They have a shame bifnei atzman. They're like an object unto themselves, and therefore they do not need assessment in context. You don't look at them like regular vegetation or regular growing items, because rather growing items, you look at them in context of a larger field or a context of where they're growing. A deck, when something is so chashuv, it has independent assessment, and therefore the halachos like the resh galuta when it comes to these dekalim of Persian dekalim. Eliezer Zeira, it's a very interesting case here, the Gemara is going to have over here. Havasai Misane Uchme, he was wearing black shoes. Vikai Bishuk and the Narda, and he was standing in the shuk of Narda. Ashkechua de Bei Resh Galuta, the men of the Resh Galuta found him there. Barmalei, Maishnahani Masanai. Why is this guy walking around in black shoes over here? Zamalu, de Kamilna, Yushalayim. I'm Mitabel on Yushalayim. I'm wearing black because of Avelus. Therefore, I'm wearing black shoes because I'm Mitabel on Yushalayim. Amulei, At Chashivat, Bulei on Yushalayim. You're such a Chashiv individual, meaning that you're so important that you can be Mitabel on Yushalayim, as opposed to the other Jews who don't do that. Sover Yehura Hava. They thought that this was haughtiness or a arrogance of sorts. At Yuhav Chavshua, they took him and they locked him up. because he had acted in a manner of Yura, to assume that he had the ability to be Mitabel and Yushalayim and be different than the other Jews, so that he was so important that he could be Mitabel and Yushalayim and wear black shoes. He says back to them, he says, listen, buddies, you know, you guys are locking me up here. I'm a big dude. How could you lock me up? I'm like, hey, Minayadina, how do we know you're a big guy? How do we know you're one of the big guns here? Take your choice. Right? Dealer's choice here. Do you want to ask me a question, or I'll ask you a question to show you that I'm a big gun? So they said to him, you know what? You go ahead. You ask. So he asked them, Eliezer Zira asked them, Hai manda katz kufra my mishalim. Someone who cuts off a fruit, this is a fruit, is a tamar, that's the size of a boat, or unripened dates. Someone who cut off an unripened date, mishalim, how does he pay? So I'm like, mishalim to make ofra. Let him pay for an unripened date, the value of an unripened date. Says, but ha'abu tamre, how could you answer that? In the end, this unripened date would have reached maturity and been a real date. So how can he just pay for an unripened date when he really stole in the end or did damage that didn't allow him to get to a full state of maturity? So Amalei, so they said, all right, fine, Mishalim Demei Tamrei. So let him pay for a date at full maturity. Amalei, V'halav Tamrei Shakolminei. In the end, he didn't take a date. He took it when it was still unripened. Who says that it's going to reach the point of being a date? So Amalei, so they said back to him, Eimalanat. Well, why don't you tell us the answer? So Amalei, B'shishim. The way we solve that problem is to assess them in the context of 60 times. Right, by doing that, we look at maybe their full value or what they would reach, but in the context of 60 times. So you don't over-assess the value, but again, you don't under-assess the value. So Amalei, Man Amar Kavatech, who holds like you or your position? Amalei, HaShmuel, Chai, Shmuel is still alive, Ubeitino Kayam, and his Beis Din still around, right? He holds like me, or this is where I heard this halacha from. So Shadrach made a Shmuel, they sent the halacha to Shmuel, or sent the question to Shmuel, Amalei, Shapi Kamar Luchu, B'shishim v'shevkuah. Says he told you the right answer. The right answer is we do it in the context of 60 times. V'shevkuah, and they let him go because he proved that he was a big gun over here. Now, the one question, this Tosfos discusses this in the sugya. The sugya comes up in a number of places. It comes up in the Gemara Tanis, comes up in the Gemara Beitz, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin. In all these places, Tosfos discusses the issue of black shoes. The Jews really wear black shoes. The implications from this Gemara are that Jews did not wear black shoes. That Jews typically wore white shoes. Right, they wore sneakers, and then this individual went out of his way and wore black shoes, and that's what made him unusual here. And he says that was mitabel Yerushalayim, but that was considered mechsei kiyura. That was considered to be arrogance to wear black shoes. But we know there are a couple of issues with that. So now that sounds well with the Gemara in Tanis. So Gemara in Tanis says also that Gemara is there discussing about Eliyahu Novi is talking to people, showing him one of the Tanoim. Showing him people in the Shuk, and he's saying about these individuals that they're Bnei Olam Haba. So one of the people they say going back, they're describing he was wearing black shoes. And there it says again, he was wearing black shoes. Why? Because he didn't want to look Jewish. So that's why they were surprised that this guy was a Bnei Olam Haba, and the Gemara goes on with the story. But again, the implication from the Gemara in Tanis is that white shoes are what Jews normally wore. Black shoes were not the shoes of the Jews. So now, the problem with that is that there's a Mishnah in Beitzah. The Mishnah in Beitzah says that you can't send somebody a shoe on Yom Tov. Why? Because it's not a gift he can use right away. Why is it a gift he can't use right away? Because it's still missing the gear. You still have to put the coloring, the black coloring on the shoe before it's wearable. So if that's the case, it implies what? That a white shoe is not a wearable shoe. You have to blacken the shoe before you can wear it. So the implications from that are that a normal shoe is a black shoe. So the Rabbeinu Tam solves the problem. It says there's a difference between the shoe and the shoelace. Right? That typically Jews wore black shoes. That is true. But they wore white shoelaces. They wore black shoes with white shoelaces. That explains the Gemara in Beitzah, the Mishnah in Beitzah, why you can't wear a white shoe, because that's not a finished shoe. Black shoes are finished shoes. Now, our Gemara over here that says he was walking, he looked unusual. And same thing with the Gemara in Tanis, which says it's unusual. The Rabbeinu Tam says that's because he's wearing black shoelaces. Everybody, Jews, normally wore black shoes with white shoelaces, but this individual is wearing even black shoelaces with his black shoes. And that's what made it unusual over here. And because of that, that is why they questioned him. And that will fit in with the Gemara. There's a Mishnah, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the end of Perek Ben Soro Marer. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that when it comes to Gzeres HaShmad, a time that there are Gzerot against the Jews, Even if there's a gzera about what type of shoelaces they have to wear, afilu arkadu l'masane, even about a shoelace, you're not allowed to be over that din, and you have to give up your life, even for something as simple as a minhag of what colored shoelaces they wear. So Rabbeinu Tam says, that's exactly the point. Jews wear white shoelaces. If the gzera sashmad comes and they say you have to wear black shoelaces, right, you have to give up your life for that if it's time of gzera sashmad. That's where Rabbeinu Tam squares away all these gemaras. And sure, there are other rishonim who disagree, the Riff and the Rush, that in general believe that Jews wore that Israel wore shchorot, that they had black shoes, right? But the other non-Jews wore red shoes or something else. They wore some sort of colored shoes, and that was the difference between them. That everybody agrees white shoes are not considered to be complete shoes. They both agree that you have to have colored shoes. Question is that the Jews had black shoes and the non-Jews wore other colors. They wore maroon and red and other colored shoes. So that's the difference over here. It's not about the shoelace. The Rabbeinu Tam is this big chiddush that the difference was in their shoelaces, not in the shoe. The other Rishonim believe, no, that the Jews wore unique shoes, and the unique shoes were that they wore black, right, the black shoes, or they wore black shoes as opposed to the colored shoes of the other non-Jews. All right, back in the Gemara. The last line in the Mishnah, if you remember from the beginning of the parak, the last line in the Mishnah was Rabbi Shimon Omer, Achla Perot Gimurim. If he eats fruits that are fully ripened, then he pays back fruits that are ripened. My taima. Adam Arachmano Bir Bisteacher. What happened to the pasuk Bir Bisteacher that we assess it against the backdrop of the whole field or 60 times? That's only true. That's when they still need the field. Right? That's not Hani came to the Trich Lesadeh Beinayu Bayushlume. Since these fruits that are fully ripened no longer need the sustenance of the field, therefore, they're considered detached from the field. It's as if you just took a crate of fruit and you destroyed a crate of fruit. There you pay for the fruit because they're no longer considered to be a part of the field itself. And I mentioned this in other places. Rabbi Shimon has a similar opinion in other places that kol amed livatzer, anything that's ready to be picked, kibatzur dami. It's as if it's been picked already. Same thing over here. Since it's already ripened enough to be picked, it's as if it's been separated or detached from the field. So Amar Avuna Bar Chia, Amar Imriya Bar Abba, Dan Rav ki Rabbi Meir. In one instance, Rav paskind or gave in a case like Rabbi Meir. Upasak ilchasa ki Rabbi Shimon. In another place, he gave pesak alach. He taught the students alachas like Rabbi Shimon. What are these cases? Dan Rav ki Rabbi Meir. Where did he paskin in a case like Rabbi Meir? The Tanya kotav l'rishon velo chatmalo l'sheni v'chatmalo avdak tuvata divi Rabbi Meir. So here's a case where the husband is selling property that is designated for the woman's ketubah. So then, in order to sell the property, the husband can't create a full sale because the woman has a lien on this property for a ksuba. But what happens if the woman also co-signs the contract? If she co-signs the contract, has she given up her rights of ketubah to this piece of land? So Gemara says, well, it depends what happened. If katav l'rishon, there was a transaction with one individual, velochat malo, and the wife did not agree to sign onto that contract. But there was a second contract, a second sale by the husband, a different buyer, a second sale. And there on that document, she does sign. So there, Rabbi Meir says, Avdak Tubata. She loses out her ksuba. Why does she lose her ksuba? Because what is the claim that the woman can make? The claim that the woman can make is what Rabbi Huda says in a minute. Rabbi Huda, Omer Yecholahi Shetemar, Nachat Ruach Asiti Levali. Right? So I wanted to make my husband happy. Atem Malachem Alai. What are you coming to me for? I was married. I wanted my husband to feel good, so I signed. He told me sign on the line over here, so I signed to make him happy. But that's not because I really wanted to sell. It's not because I really gave up my rights to the property. I was just making my husband happy. So that's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. So why does Rabbi Meir hold differently? What's the difference by Rabbi Meir? That's because, what did she do in this case? If she was trying to make her husband happy, she just should have signed on all the documents. And we said over here, what in the first case, the first sale, she's not signed on it. She's only signed on the second sale. So you can't say that she was trying to make her husband happy. If she was trying to make her husband happy, she would have been signed on the first sale and the second sale. The fact that she skipped the sale tells you that she really intends to, in the second case, to sell it, but she didn't in the first case. So there, Rav paskin like Rabbi Meir. Now, where is the Hilchasok Rabbi Shimon? Where is the Loch like Rabbi Shimon? Ki hadetznan, Rabbi Shimon Omer, achla perut gmurim, mishalemet perut gmurim. Im sa'asa, im sataim sataim. There, Rab taught the loch is like Rabbi Shimon, that when you have ripened fruit in a field, you assess the damage value on those fruits themselves. You don't look at it in the context of the field. Okay, new Mishnah. Next Mishnah says, Hamadgish. This is a Mishnah we quoted earlier in the Gemara, Amadish betoks de chavero shlo bershut. Person takes his fruit, his vegetables, his grains, and he piles them up in his friend's property without permission. And the owner of the field, his animal comes along and eats that which he put there. Patur. The only animal is patur because you have no rights to put your stuff in this individual's field. If his animal, the owner of the field's animal, gets damaged by the fruits or vegetables or vegetation or grains that were placed there by this individual, balagadish chayav, right? The one who put the pile there is chayav. He's got to compensate. He's got to make up because he did it without permission. I hurt the balabais's animal. Vimhidgish birshut balasadeh chayav. On the other hand, if it was with the permission of the balasadeh, then you are chayav. I mean, once the balasadeh gives him permission, then if it gets eaten, right, then the balasadeh now is going to have to compensate or replace that which his animal took from this individual. So when it says lematznan to lokarabi, let's say our mission is like lokarabi, because I made a definitive statement here that once the balasadeh agrees to let you in, then he's responsible for the items. Well, that happened to be a machlokas chachamim rabbi. Is it when you say stam, ol, come in, you can put your stuff down, does that mean come in and I'm going to watch it? Or does it when it say come in, it means come in, but I'm not necessarily going to watch it for you, right? That's the question. So rabbi's of the opinion that stam, when you make no clear indication, right, then the din is no watching, no responsibility for watching. So lema tznan to loka rabbi, dika rabbi, amarachi kabela balabait lishmor. So the balabait has to explicitly say that he's going to accept achrayut over here. So amar rav papa, hocha, even rabbi could agree to the mishter. Why? Because we're talking about here, but not the beidari askinen. We're talking about an individual who basically is he's like the town store. It's where everybody brings their stuff to put after they've harvested. So he's the shomer hagranot. He watches over all the silos. So everybody comes to silo their food with him. So by definition, when he gives you permission to put it with him, the underlying assumption with such an individual is that he's also going to watch it. Since he's the one who takes care of all the silos for the whole town, when you bring it to him, there's an underlying assumption or an underlying, you know, implicit statement that does not have to be dictated, which is that he's going to watch it also. When he says, gives him permission to bring it into my field and pile it up or put it in my silos, it's clear that I'm going to watch it for you because that's my job and that's what the intent of placing it in my silos is. Therefore, even according to Rabbi, he could agree in this case because there's an implicit acceptance of responsibility even though it was not stated. Right now, this next Mishnah, again, is a Mishnah that we saw quoted earlier in the Gemara a number of times. Hashaleach. And we'll start the Gemara on it today, and then we'll finish it up with tomorrow. We'll discuss some more of the issues. Shaleach et bei rabbi yad chereshot v'katan. Someone sends a fire with a chereshot v'katan. Patur b'dinei adam v'chayav b'dinei shemayim. Patur b'dinei adam chayav b'dinei shemayim because it is grama b'alma, right? It's grama b'nizikin, and grama b'nizikin, you're not chayav. Shalach b'yad pikeach, pikeach chayav. He sends along with somebody who is of sound mind, then that person becomes responsible for whatever happens to the fire. Echad eviyat or. Someone brings, the first guy brought a flame or a fire, and the second guy brought the fuel for the fire. The one who brought the fuel is chayav, because if it had not been for the fuel, the fire would have just been stationary, nothing would have happened. The fact that he put the fuel here is what caused the fire to spread. If the one who was there first was the bringer of the wood, right? And then the next guy brings a flame and puts it over there, then a meviat or chayav. Then the one who brings the flame is chayav. Why? Because the sticks were there before and he would put them down, they would have done nothing. The only reason anything happened here is because this second individual brought a fire and lit them. So he's the cause of all the damage that happens here. So the basic principle is whoever comes last is the one who's responsible for the spread, because without the two of them together, need to come together, they need a partnership to create the nezek. But that nezek is only caused by the second one coming, because the first one is not sufficient in itself to create the nezek. Now, ba'acher v'liba, if another, a third person comes along and blows on the either coal or the fire or the flame that causes it to spread, then the one who caused the fire to spread by blowing on it is going to be chayav. Again, because without him, even if you had the flame and the fuel, the fire would not have spread. It requires the blowing on the fire to cause it to spread. Livta ruach, if it's the wind that blew the fire and caused the spreading, kulan puturim. They're all patur in this case. Again, what type of ruach? What are we talking about here? That will be discussion in the Gemara. Amar Reish Lakish, Mishmei Dechizkiah. So we already saw this machlokes before between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says the name of Chizkiah, Lo Shano Shemasalo Gachelet Viliba. The case in our Mishnah where he's patur is a case where he gives over a coal to the Chereshot of a Katan, And then the Shekher Shah Zagan blows on the coal. Aval Masalo Shahab, if he gives him a flame, Chayav. Then it's Chayav, my time, Masav Gamerlo. His actions are what caused the problem. So again, if he hands him a lit flame, then it's just a matter of time before the flame is alight somewhere on some fuel. So he basically caused that problem. He's the one who caused it, and if he's going to be responsible in that case. The case where he's patur when he gives the chershot to cut is when he gives him a coal. A coal by itself is not going to cause a fire. What you need is some sort of oxygen or fuel. So if the chershot to cut blow on the coal, and that's what causes the coal to ignite or then light on, then he can't be held responsible for that because that's not what he did. All he gave him was a coal. He didn't tell him to blow on it. He's not responsible for them blowing on it. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, a few masarlo shall have it patur. Yochanan goes even further and says, even if he's carrying a flame and he gives it over to Cherishot V'katan, he's patur. My time, huh? Tzavto the Cherish Garmalo. Right? It's the actions, right? The actions or the nature of the Cherishot V'katan that caused the problem over here. V'lo mechayev. So when is the case you are chayev? Achim sorlo gavzo silta shraga. So he hands him over thin twigs, kindling, and a flame. Because then if he hands it, it's like bari chazekin. That's it. He has a flame in one hand, and you hand him the fuel in the other hand. That, like all likelihood, they're coming together. If they're coming together, then you're already responsible because that's an outcome you should have been aware of or you should have seen coming. Because there, clearly, it's your action that's causing the problem. Because you handed him the fuel and the fire, and by doing that, there's nothing missing except for him to put his hands together, and the whole thing will be alight. So because of that, you'll be responsible, even according to Rabbi Yochanan. So again, the machlokes between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan is, right, how bari a chazeka do you need? How obvious it has to be that there's hezek here. So according to Rabbi Yochanan, the only time it's bari hezek is if you hand them basically the fuel and the flame in each hand, and then then it's so clear that there's going to be a bad outcome here, then you're chayav. But it comes to the case, right, where where you give it over a chershot to katan, either you give them a coal or you give them a flame, either one in itself, that will not, they will be patur. Because in neither of those cases did you give the chershot to katan enough to start the fire right there. He still has to take the fire to something else. He still has to light a fuel of some sort. So because of that, you are patur, because it's not your ma'asim that did it. Reish Lakish says no. So he says, when we say the ma'asim of the chershot of a katan did something, that's when you have a coal and he blows on it. But if you hand him a flame, the chershot of the katan really has to do almost nothing. He just has to move a couple feet and the whole place will be on fire. You can light anything he wants on fire. So that's already considered bari hazek according to Reish Lakish. In that instance, you will be, right, chayav, for handing him a shalhevet. Okay, we'll stop over here.